Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe All Show podcast. Today on the pod, housing crunch. With rents continuing to move upwards, tenants now call for a cap on rent hikes, even when renters move out. Plus, zipping away. We'll look at the City of Vancouver's e-bikes here service that will launch later this year. And Underground Highway. Tech contributor Andy Brar joins us from Las Vegas, where he shares his experience driving through a subterranean tunnel for electric vehicles. That's all next on the Jazz Joe All Show podcast. Last September, former Premier John Horgan announced a 2% rent increase cap for 2023, which just came into effect just a few days ago. Now, while housing advocates agree that capping rent increases rather than tying them to the inflation rate will limit the cost of living increases for some renters, it doesn't address the real problem of creating housing instability for tenants, the economic incentive for landlords to evict them. That's the core issue. Now, a Victoria area housing organization wants to see more done, specifically barring landlords to jack up rent significantly when a new tenant signs a lease. Joining me now to discuss the proposal is Douglas King. He's the executive director of the Together Against Poverty Society in Victoria. Doug, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's touch a little bit about your organization, TAP's advocacy for the vacancy control system, a vacancy control system. How would it work?
Yeah, so TAPS is one of the largest nonprofit legal providers on Vancouver Island. And this vacancy control proposal that we have is really based out of our work giving direct representation to tenants day in by day, you know, speaking to them about their problems and seeing the kind of increase in rent. Vacancy control is all about trying to control the rate of rent and stop it from having these kind of significant dramatic changes year over year. In the last 2 years, especially, we've seen that rate of rent increase in our urban centers by, you know, over 15%. Vacancy control is designed to slow that growth and try to keep it more manageable over time.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other jurisdictions that do what you are advocating for?
There are actually. There's vacancy control in Quebec. There's actually been vacancy control for a long, long time in Quebec. A very, very kind of entrenched system there. PEI is also another province that has vacancy control written to their Residential Tenancy Act, and it specifically states that rent is tied to the unit and not to the individual, and a landlord is regulated by how much they can raise rent in between tenancies, which really is what vacancy control is all about. We actually had vacancy control here in British Columbia. We had it in the 80s, the last time that we had really significant inflation problems, really concerns about cost of living. The NDP government in the 80s introduced vacancy control, and it wasn't a very effective tool for making sure that those kind of high inflationary costs and cost of living costs didn't cause rent to kind of get to a point where it was unmanageable.
So for our listeners, so when a tenant leaves a lease agreement, moves on, of course, the landlord would advertise the suite, and I'm going to assume, I'm going to pick a number out of the air. Let's say a tenant for a one-bedroom condominium was paying for, let's say, $2,200 a month. That landlord can look at the market and say, you know what, I could probably get $2,400 or $2,500 a month. That is going to be my asking price, and I will go from there. So that's what you're essentially wanting to eliminate, is that significant increase between tenants.
Yeah, exactly. And really, when you think about it, you know, we already control rent during a tenancy. So when someone is in a tenancy, you know, there's provincial regulations on how much rent can be increased year over year. And really all vacancy control does is extend that in between tenancies as well and make it not tied to the individual, but tied to the unit. And the reason for that is because, you know, when we keep having a system where landlords are able to put up units for as much as the market can bear, when you combine that with what we've had in British Columbia over the last at least of a decade now, which is really, really low vacancy rates, high competition for units, then the cost of rent is going to keep driving up and up and up. And honestly, we're starting to see this stratification within our rental market, where the only people that can afford rent are typically very high income earners. The lowest income earners are being shut out entirely of the market. And whereas before, we had a relatively small amount of people that needed government support to be housed, that number is increasing year over year, and as we build more social housing, we still can't catch up to the amount of people that need that support.
What do you say to the argument that, look, these landlords are putting up their capital, their hard-earned money, they have, in many cases, mortgages to pay on that very property, Mortgages that, by the way, if they're on variable rate, have gone up significantly because of inflation. They're dealing with probably higher insurance costs, repairs that are required. Those are not fixed costs either. In many cases, they're also going up higher than the rate of inflation or even a 2% increase as it is this year. What do you say to that argument to a landlord? Say, wait a minute, I've got costs too, and they're going up a lot more than 2% a year.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's a legitimate concern. And I think the reality is, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, if you institute vacancy control, there will be a financial cost to some landowners and some landlords because they won't be able to recover some of their costs and related to kind of these large increases in rent. Now, the way that we look at it is that at the end of the day, when somebody purchases a property, especially when they take on a mortgage, they're signing a contract and they're taking on responsibility and liability, especially if they signed a variable rate mortgage. When you sign a variable rate mortgage, you sign on to the possibility that those rates are going to change, and you have to be responsible yourself for those changes. You can't necessarily just pass on the mistakes that you have made financially onto your tenants. And that's really what we hear from landlords, is part of their business plan is being able to essentially make tenants responsible for their profits. And then if those profits become endangered because of the financial market change, you know, really it's about passing it on to the person who's lowest on the totem pole and saying, well, if I can make my tenant pay for this, then that's great. For most landlords, the cost that they have in relation to ownership of their building is not something, they have a flexibility, I guess, that's there that tenants don't have. They always have the option to sell. If they get to a point where it's not financially viable, they're not making a profit, they always have the ability to sell their property and put it up on the market. Tenants don't have that. Tenants don't have the ability to just move into another property like that. What they face is eviction. And really what we're seeing right now is kind of this constant pressure on tenants to cover the costs of landlords, to ensure the profits of landlords, when all they're trying to do is just ensure they have a place to live.
Do you believe that there is a role for the private sector in dealing with our housing challenges? And what I mean by that is that, as you just said, if a rental suite for a landlord is not financially viable, they should sell it. But if that were to come to fruition in a larger scale, does that not also lead to the a restriction on how many people actually build and sell condos, which is the private sector? I mean, without these landlords making money and a profit, it may mean less housing gets built, or there's a heavier reliance on the public and the public sector, which means government, to build. Do you not scare away potential supply when you start saying that, look, too bad, landlords, if you're not making money, just sell your property? Many folks may not build. Developers may not build because it's not viable for some that do invest in these condos.
Yeah, I think one of the greatest myths of vacancy control is that it would suppress development. What we have found in jurisdictions where it's been instituted is that in some ways it actually has the opposite effect, because if vacancy control is in place in the residential tenancy market, the only units that can be put on the market for as much as possible, as much as the market can bear, with as much increase as you want, are new units. So, you know, property developers know that if they're creating new housing, they're going to get an added benefit from that because they're going to be able to put it on the market for as much as they possibly can. You know, we've definitely seen a slowdown in development unrelated to the cost of rent because of the cost of you know, inflation has impacted materials, all of those things. And one of the things that's really difficult about the housing market is all of these things are interconnected. You know, vacancy control is really about protecting tenants and boiling it down to the thing that's the most important right now, which is that we can't keep having these years where rent goes up 15 or 20%. We can't keep squeezing the market like that because, you know, at the end of the day, there has to be a place in the private market for tenants. We want the private market to be housing people, because if we can't afford places to live in the private market, if low-income earners and working poor can't actually afford to live in the private market, then we're spending more and more tax dollars. We're spending millions and billions of dollars to try to subsidize their housing and create housing that's affordable for them. And that's something that we're never going to be able to outpace. We're never going to be able to build enough housing to house every single person who makes less than $50,000 a year.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking to Douglas King. He's an executive director for Together Against Poverty Society, and TAPS is advocating for a vacancy control system similar to other jurisdictions like Quebec and other provinces. Essentially, if you own a rental suite as a landlord, you would raise the rent by about 2% a year, as is the case now, depending on what the consumer price index says, rather than seeing those significant increases when a tenant moves out and a new tenant comes in. Douglas, give me a sense of the stories you're hearing in Victoria, where you're located, in regards to you advocating for this. What kind of stories are you hearing?
Yeah, so one of the other reasons why we're strong proponents of vacancy control is because, you know, in addition to trying to control those increases in rent year over year, trying to limit it to a manageable amount. Vacancy control offers protection as well, and it offers protection to what we see as some of the most vulnerable tenants in the market. So we have a situation right now where it's often the best tenants that are the most vulnerable and being punished right now. If you have a tenant who's lived in a building for 30 or 40 years, during the duration of that tenancy, they've benefited from rent control. And the landlord hasn't been able to increase the rent because they haven't moved out. So it's the longest tenured tenants. It's often seniors. It's people who have been living in their suites for decades. And obviously they are good tenants because they continue to live in their suites for decades. Those are the ones who are the most risk of eviction right now. And they're being targeted for eviction because to a landlord, if that suite can be vacated, then the rent can be increased sometimes by, you know, almost double the amount right now, because, you know, for people who have been living in these low-rise apartments especially, their rent is so far off the market rate that it's really difficult for landlords not to see the incentivization of profit there. So vacancy control also protects those tenants because it takes away the incentive for a landlord to evict an individual solely for the purpose of raising rent. And another thing we need to remember is there are mechanisms out there for a landlord to raise rent that doesn't involve eviction.
How successful do you think you're going to be in regards to the advocacy of this particular proposal? I know Premier Eby has been talking about looking at things differently when it comes to housing and rentals. He's got a new housing minister, Ravi Kalo. How successful do you think you'll be in regards to this particular proposal for government?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a time will tell kind of issue. You know, I think the government has been very, very clear that they want to try to impact the housing market and create an affordable housing market. They want to do that primarily through taxation and not through things like rent regulation. We've been trying this for a long time now, and nothing seems to be working. And I think what you're starting to hear is a much, much stronger voice, especially from the younger generation. You know, people who are in their 20s, early 30s, who are really clearly priced out of the market. You're starting to hear them be much more vocal about what they want government to do. And it's not taxation. It's not a little bit of support to try to get into a mortgage. It's really substantial systemic change in how we view housing and stop kind of the commodification of housing, which has gotten us into this crisis that we're in. So, you know, we're not under the illusion that the current government is going to look at vacancy control immediately across the board. That being said, you know, we're starting to see local governments look at vacancy control for specific types of housing that they want to protect. The city of Vancouver recently introduced the first municipal form of vacancy control on SRO buildings in Vancouver, and that is in the court system right now as it's been challenged. So we're very much looking at that and looking at the possibility of local government being able to kind of pick up the mantle of vacancy control if the province isn't willing to do it.
Doug, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In just a few minutes, the puck will drop in Halifax as Canada goes for the gold against Czechia at the World Junior Hockey Championships. The defending champs advanced to the final, the 6-2 win over the United States, while the Czechs dumped Sweden 2-1 in the other semifinal. Now, North Vancouver's Connor Bedard is the tournament's leading scorer with 8 goals and 21 points. Joining me now to talk about the World Juniors and hockey here in British Columbia and across Canada and the state of hockey is Global BC's sports director, Squire Barnes. Squire, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every tournament when you think of hockey attracts attention, but maybe it's just me on social media or just watching way too many sports shows, but this one seems special in the sense of excitement and energy. What's your sense of it in regards to this year's World Championships?
Well, I think it helps when you have what's considered a generational player wearing a Canadian uniform. And Connor Bedard has captured the imagination. Not that people didn't know about him before. The hockey fan knew about him. The peripheral hockey fan, sports fan, is now learning about Connor Bedard and the brilliance, you know, he's put on as a junior, not just at the international level, but also in the Western Hockey League. He plays for the Regina Pats. But I think when you have a kid like this and he's wearing a Canadian uniform, that brings in more attention than usually is afforded. And a lot of attention is usually afforded this tournament, but Connor is making it even more intense.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe Canada's play in this tournament so far?
Well, I think at the start, they were a little discombobulated. In fact, the team they're playing today for the gold medal, Czechia, beat Canada on Boxing Day when the tournament began, 5-2. And it was a shock to the Canadians to lose in that fashion. But Canada that day didn't look like they were set. You know, these tournaments are essentially an all-star tournament. These kids don't play together. They're sort of put together very quickly, and then they have to, you know, develop their chemistry fast. And I don't think Canada's chemistry was quite there on opening day. So this game today is going to be interesting in the fact that Czechia was able to beat Canada, but I think this Canadian team is going to be a lot different than the one we saw on Boxing Day.
What's your sense of the state of hockey at a local or even a junior level? In the context of what we've been covering on this show and many others, when it comes to Hockey Canada, you know, I was, as a hockey dad, you know, I've been watching all of this very closely, covering it as well. What's your sense of what hockey has gone through and continues to go through? It's not over. And in the context of all the excitement you're actually seeing in this tournament?
I think people, you know, put their concern and anger towards the people who were running Hockey Canada. In the case of this particular team, these kids had nothing to do with what happened before. All the terrible things that we've heard about, it has nothing to do with this particular team. And I think hockey fans can separate that they can cheer for this particular team and these kids, and, you know, separate that from what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, in regards to the context of hockey, how important is what's occurring and has occurred so far, but it's still occurring in the context of Hockey Canada. Do you think we're going to see that systemic change that many are asking for?
I think so. I hope so. But I think there's been enough of a glare of the spotlight, and it's not over yet. And it certainly is needed. I mean, you know, we've seen the Hockey Canada board get changed now. Mm-hmm. Like, remember, at the start of all of this, the people who ran Hockey Canada were very, you know, defensive and not like trying to hold back, you know, the hordes and try to stay in charge of everything. And eventually, you know, the glare of the media, the anger of the general public knocked that wall down. So I think there is going to be a systemic change. I think it's happening already.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good.
One of the things when you brought up the issue of Connor Bedard is that he's a North Shore player. We've had stars in the NHL who have come from the Metro Vancouver area. I was talking to one of my colleagues here at the station earlier today, a parent as well, and what she said is, you know, I'm not going to steer my kids towards hockey. And it wasn't not for a love of hockey. It's the expense of hockey, particularly in the Vancouver area, ice time. We're not making too many rinks anymore just because of the cost of land. You know, and generally when you think about stars in hockey, you think of always small town Canada, less so about big cities. Not that, like I've said, we've had stars come out of Vancouver before, but it is unique in the sense that Connor Bedard is from Metro Vancouver, and he, as you say, has a very good chance of being drafted as number one. But hockey has also got challenges in our city too, doesn't it? Just in regards to living and expense and the sport itself.
Yeah, well, even going back to when I was a kid, there weren't a lot of great BC players. And the general feeling back then was, well, you know, on the prairies or in Ontario and in Quebec, you can skate on ice in the wintertime and you don't have to actually go to a rink. It's free. Just strap on some skates, get a stick and a puck, and away you go. And in BC, especially in the Vancouver, Metro Vancouver area, that isn't really the case. Like, you don't see Deer Lake or Burnaby Lake or Lost Lagoon freezing over and everybody goes and plays hockey on it. It doesn't happen. So you have to, you know, rent the rink, and that's expensive. I don't have children, So I only hear this from others, but it is an expensive sport to play. It's not really a sport you see a lot of kids who are from families who struggle with money play, mm-hmm. because they just don't have the means to do that. Now, not every kid who plays in BC is from a wealthy family, but it's, you don't see as many kids able to play in this part of the world as easily as you can play on the prairies and in Ontario and Quebec with the winters.
Yeah, for me, it was always the early morning hours, and I know a lot of hockey parents.
Well, that's true.
Right? So my son says, Dad,
the other thing.
Yeah, but he says, Dad, I want to focus on basketball. I was doing cartwheels in my head. I tell you that much. There aren't too many 5 a.m. basketball practices.
Yeah, the kids in northern Saskatchewan, they can get the ice at 11 a.m. just by going outside. You know, the kids in B.C. have to get up at, you know, like they're farmers and get up at 5 in the morning to go to the rink. It's funny, you know, you mentioned Metro Vancouver. You're right. There's been some very good hockey players come out of this area. But when you compare it to other parts of Canada, there aren't as many. And I think it's, you know, strictly because of the weather and the fact that you have to go to the rinks to play, and it's not cheap.
That's true. Well, great to see Connor Bedard there. And as you said, he's the leading scorer with 8 goals and 21 points. And we'll be cheering on Canada throughout the show as well. Thanks so much, Squire. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jazz.
Well, in the first hour, we talked to Douglas King. He's the executive director of the Together Against Poverty Society, which is based in Victoria. Now, his organization, like some elected officials, are advocating for vacancy control. Now, essentially, when one tenant leaves a unit, the rent would remain the same, subject only to the allowed 2% annual increase. It would bar landlords from setting a new rate at what the market can bear, which is permitted now. So essentially, if a tenant moves out, a new tenant comes in, you can set the price as a landlord. And Mr. King and his organization, Together Against Poverty Society, and some municipal politicians are saying, look, we need to get rid of that, actually. But when it comes to this issue, I think it's important we speak to landlords as well. Joining me now is David Hutniak, CEO of Landlord BC. David, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's get to the core issue here. We were speaking to Douglas King, for the executive director of Together Against Poverty Society, and his organization is basically saying that landlords essentially shouldn't be able to increase rents once a tenant moves out and a new tenant moves in. Your thoughts on that assessment?
Well, to be perfectly candid, it never ceases to amaze me how, you know, certain stakeholders continue to insist that the impact of vacancy control is benign and that there are no unintended consequences. And that's simply flat out wrong and frankly hugely harmful to renters and our communities. The reality is vacancy control, if implemented, would have huge detrimental effects to existing owners and operators of rental housing in terms of their ability to make continued investment. And equally, if not more importantly, considering we have a supply crisis, it would basically ensure that rental developers and the lenders who give them money to build purpose-built rental housing would go to other jurisdictions. There would simply be no business case to build rental here. So this is to suggest this versus, supporting supply and some other solutions that government can take is literally a scorched earth approach and would have consequences that we would be suffering for decades, to be very candid with you.
Now, one of the arguments being made in support of this proposal is that, look, other jurisdictions have something similar, like Quebec, like PEI. Do you know of any jurisdictions that do this and where they are successful and still are able to provide adequate supply?
Well, PEI has, you know, a few hundred rental units, so I don't think that that's, a jurisdiction that we should be considering. The one that actually comes is brought up more frequently than not by advocates for this measure is Manitoba. And without getting too deep into exactly what they're doing, simply put, yes, they do have vacancy control, but what they've done is built in a whole series of sort of exemptions, basically. And the end result is that It's what I guess we would describe it as an extremely watered down version of vacancy control. Despite the fact that it's watered down significantly, you know, Manitoba has probably some of the oldest rental housing and the fewest number of new units built of any province in the country, and simply because, to support what I said earlier, the business case to continue to invest in the existing stock is largely not there. And again, in terms of building new rental stock, while we did see a small uptick there, 5-6 years ago, leading into to the pandemic, largely because land is so cheap there and interest rates were so low, vacancy control in that province, even as they have it structured, is detrimental to any serious consideration by developers and lenders to build rental there. So that's if you want to look at an example of how it quote unquote works, that's a great example.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 2023, the government last September, I believe, that was the time, announced a 2% rent increase cap for 2023. The industry has been dealing with those caps for a few years now. Give me a sense of what you're hearing from landlords in regards to their properties, upkeep, and just the overall environment here in the Lower Mainland for them.
Well, obviously, that was really disappointing that the province made that decision. And, we get it. These are really challenging times for everybody, and renters, are obviously in some tough situations here with inflation and just the cost of living in general, and so they made that decision. Our industry, as a result, the legislated increase was 5.4%. It was cut back to 2%. I mean, that represents probably $500 million plus haircut for our sector in 2023. So we're subsidizing renters to that tune in 2023 in addition to regular rent control. So, I mean, from our perspective, again, these are challenging times. But, it just seems like there's a real degree of unfairness there when you consider other, food and everything else is increasing in cost, and we don't see any measures there. But having said that, at the end of the day, the province knows, and certainly the new premier and the new housing minister are acutely aware that the solution here is to get supply. We feel very confident that they are prepared to work with our sector, the private sector, to increase that supply. We kind of all missed an opportunity with low interest rates by not getting enough rental built. There's going to be action taken against municipalities who are, putting up barriers and stalling the process. So from that perspective, we're going to look at things positively here. But absolutely, we're in a tough situation here, and the last thing we need is, folks suggesting, additional regulation, and especially anything approaching vacancy control. I mean, it would just make no sense at all.
I'm curious, my final question to you, once this rental cap, as I said, it's 2%, that's what landlords can raise rents by in 2023 is 2%. Once these caps are lifted, if these caps are lifted, are we going to see a significant jump that first year in your mind, like a 5-10% increase because of these caps have been in place for a few years now?
No, absolutely not, because the formula is CPI. It's British Columbia CPI, and it's actually lagged because of how the calculation is done via the as defined in the RTA. So, we're all acutely aware of what the Bank of Canada is doing, and it's very conceivable that by the end of 2023 or earlier, we're going to see some meaningful reduction in the inflation rate and CPI affected accordingly. So, we're entering a lower inflationary rate, and that means that for 2024, it's not inconceivable that, the increase will be, even by the RTA formula, will be 2% or something marginally higher. We're entering, a period here once we get through 2023 of much lower inflation, of lower CPI. So, and there we go again. You know, this would have been in effect a bit of a catch-up year for two years of rent increase freezes at 1.5 last year, but you know that's the reality. So I think we're looking at much more, I guess, if you want to call it stability for renters, and you know, some challenging times for us was you know, the recovery of these few years have been is going to, you know, take a long time, if ever, mm-hmm. to be recovered.
David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Jazz. Take care.
For a third day, divided Republicans left the Speaker's chair of the U.S. House sitting empty as party leader Kevin McCarthy failed and failed again in an excruciating string of ballots to win enough GOP votes to seize the chamber's gavel. Now that's up to 4:35 Pacific time. Let's see what happens tonight. Now pressure was building as McCarthy lost the 7th and 8th rounds of voting and launched on a historic 9th ballot and 10th ballot, beating the number it took the last time this happened 100 years ago in a fight to choose a speaker in a disputed election. But with his supporters and foes seemingly stalemated, feelings of both boredom and desperation seem increasingly evident with no end in sight. In short, folks, what a mess. Joining me now is Global News Washington correspondent Reggie Cicchini to give us an update at this hour in regards to what's transpiring in Washington. Reggie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
How would you describe today? Because you've gone through multiple votes today. What's it been like in Washington?
I mean, look, this is it's difficult to watch. It's probably difficult for Republicans to watch, and it's likely difficult for the Republican base to watch, because this was a majority that was hard fought, that was far smaller than what Republicans wanted. And here they are into day three of their majority. They've got no work done yet because they have no speaker elected. There are no rules. They can't actually do anything that they promised the American people who voted for them that they would show up to Washington to do. So heading into this kind of almost unprecedented territory of at least a 10th round of voting, which, you know, the last time a 10th round was needed was 1833. This is not a good look for Republicans as they start this job.
Is there any talk that that there will be some sort of agreement in the next 24 hours, or are we remotely close?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. The House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker hopeful, repeatedly over the last couple of days has been defiant, saying that the votes are going to be there, that the deals are going to be made. But there are people who are in this kind of rebel group coming out to say that they are miles apart, that there is no deal on the table that they're willing to go for. And then there are four or five who say that they're never going to vote for Kevin McCarthy, regardless of what deal is offered. And I think the problem that you're seeing Republicans, at least the moderate Republicans, start to run into is Kevin McCarthy is whittling away the speaker to a point of where a speaker might just not be necessary because the power won't be there. That might not satisfy those who are propping him up right now, which could ultimately force the hand to get somebody else in the race. Because if McCarthy allows for the kind of few on the furthest of the right to hold all of the power, the rest of the party is not going to fall in line.
Mm-hmm. Now, how have, in your mind, and talking to the folks there, how have the Democrats treated all this, watching this, witnessing this? What has sort of their stance been?
I mean, look, from the analysts that we've spoken to over the last kind of 24, 48 hours, they're pointing to the fact that these margins that Republicans are holding right now, this very slim majority, is the exact same majority that Nancy Pelosi and her party held for the last 2 years. They all lined up behind Pelosi. It went to one round of voting and she became speaker for the second time. And also, any bill that was brought to the floor was only brought to the floor, because this is a Democrat rule, if there was 100% support from within the party, and they were able to pass through round after round after round of legislation, even with such a slim majority. So Democrats are saying, look, this is a problem that Republicans created. Republicans need to dig themselves out of the hole. They're not going to do anything to help them, because if the situation was reversed, it's hard to think any Democrat would be bailing out, any Republican would be bailing out the Democrats right now. But this is a moment for them to sit back, to say, this is your mess. You need to fix this mess, or take after what we did and act the way that we used to act.
Now, you know, we could be having this conversation tomorrow. My understanding was that there wasn't supposed to be a session tomorrow if they had gotten through the votes. Tomorrow also is the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. I guess there is some symbolism there in regards to populism, in regards to the inability at this point support a speaker, and the Republicans' inability to do so. It just highlights the fracture within the party.
Absolutely, it does. And look, January 6th, obviously, a day that many Democrats will always hold Republicans responsible for, or at least a number of Republicans, including the former president. And you're right, no sitting was the plan for how this vote was going to go. They wanted to just be able to kind of skip past January 6th and then pick things up at the beginning of next week. And I think a remarkable moment of this is there is not a speaker at the moment. And because of that, it means that the committees that were to be wiped out when Republicans officially took control haven't happened yet. So the January 6th committee and all of the information that it gathered and all of the information that still sits with the National Archives is still present and is still going to linger over this building as January 6th is marked. And that is something that I think is going to weigh heavily on the minds of many of these congressional lawmakers that are walking in or out for whatever reason, because, again, they can't come together. It was a fractured Republican Party that ultimately led to what took place on January 6th. And here we are 2 years later, and this Republican Party is still finding itself kind of the source of a political nightmare in D.C.
With what has transpired today, and easily could go into tomorrow, plus the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, is there any pressure on these elected officials when it comes to public sentiment? I mean, the public must be quite frustrated witnessing all this in the United States.
Sure. I mean, Republicans understand that the public is seeing this. And again, you know, we talked about this yesterday, that the public is seeing this because there are no rules right now. So the cameras are rolling far more than they would be. And there is a sense of frustration that is growing, not just amongst the Republican base, but kind of amongst the American base as a whole, because work is simply not getting done. And, you know, whether it's because it's a national security concern or whether it's because there are some Republicans in the base that want to see these investigations into, you know, the weaponization of departments or into the president or into Hunter Biden, none of these things can happen right now. And until this Republican Party is able to unify itself and stand behind one person, there is a growing sense of unease, because this was supposed to be Republicans' big moment to kind of own the libs and take over and kind of show America what Republican governance is about. They are struggling to do the basics in electing a Speaker of the House, and that could, you know, it could haunt them come 2 years from now when it's time for an election and, you know, there's a chance to take the White House. The base may say, well, look at what happened 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to watch where we sit, and I certainly know you have a front row seat, and we look forward to chatting with you again on this issue tomorrow. Thanks for your time today, Reggie.
Thank you.
We were speaking to Reggie Cicchini, Global News Washington correspondent, who was giving us an update on the third day of voting as divided Republicans left the Speaker's chair of the U.S. House sitting empty. Now, a new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington, and that's what you're seeing playing out in real time. And those individuals, some have said a handful, even about 30 people, 30 elected officials, Republicans, many say, are committed to stopping Speaker Kevin McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. And it is playing out, as I said, in real time tonight in Washington. It does speak to populism and the rise of extremism in our politics and our broader cultural conversation in the United States. But what's that mean to us here in Canada? Are we seeing the same sort of elements, or is it different here? Joining me now is Keith Baldry, Global BC's Legislative Bureau Chief. Good afternoon, Keith.
Hello, Jazz.
First of all, your thoughts just watching stuff in Washington. I mean, you've followed politics for years here in our province. But
no, I devour U.S. political history, U.S. history, and what's happened down there is totally unprecedented. We haven't seen it for about 100 years. And you raised the point, is what we're seeing down there, can it happen other places in terms of this rise of the political populism. And we're seeing it around the world. I've been tracking this as a political journalist, not just in the United States, but parts of Europe, where populism, which occurs basically, is based on this political argument that somehow the government is corrupt and the little guy is getting smashed by this corrupt government, therefore you sort of coalesce around some popular issues and breed mistrust in institutions and society. And we're seeing that in basically in the United States. That was what Trump was all about. If you recall his drain the swamp chant back in his first successful election campaign, which was a shot at the Washington government, that the very notion of government in the states was corrupt. And that was sort of fed what we're seeing now with the Republican Party. And I do think there's a danger you're going to see that spilling over into Canada. I was struck this past summer by a poll by the Abacus Data Polling Group, which found that 52% of the population agreed with the statement that official government accounts of events cannot be trusted, which is basically conspiracy theories. 42% felt the same way about the media news reports could not be trusted. So I think there's a rising sentiment in Canada, just like the United States and other places, where it feeds into this notion that somehow our institutions are broken and corrupt and allows this anger to be whipped up, and it's tied to nationalism. And we're seeing it, in a way, Alberta, you know, in terms of Danielle Smith, her whole approach is about, if we're now only about Alberta, we're not about Canada, we're not about a larger group, we're about a smaller group. And that's another hallmark of populism. That's part of Trump. It wasn't about being a representative of 100% of Americans. It was just his relatively minor group, but was enough to form power.
Do you, I mean, you saw the trucker convoy last year in Ottawa. You saw some of that even during the Conservative Party leadership race, and times even Conservative members of Parliament speaking at the rally, or at least at the very least being sympathetic to a lot of those that were in Ottawa protesting. Do you see us ever getting to the point? I mean, there is going to be some populism here. Of course, you can't ignore what's happening around the world. But do you think we'd ever get to the point, with regards to what you're seeing in the U.S. today, with a party that is so, even though it's a small group of people, it is fractured? Do you see that actually getting deeply embedded in Canadian culture, or even here in B.C. political culture?
Oh, I think there's always a possibility of something like that happen. I think the trucker convoy exposed the fact that there is a portion of society, not by any means a majority, but, you know, I saw a number of polls in the midst of that trucker convoy by very reputable polling firms that suggested about 25% of the population to 30% kind of supported them, even though, you know, poll after poll showed any politician associated with that was viewed about 60 to 70% in very negative terms. But you can't dismiss and ignore that 20 or 30% of the population subscribe to some fairly extreme views on both the left and the right. This is not necessarily a total right-wing thing. You saw the emergence of left-wing groups like Antifa, very much feeding into the notion that we have a corrupt society, except they approach it from a left-wing perspective rather than a right-wing. So I think there's a possibility. I'm not sure it's ever going to dominate our politics, but certainly the last year, and with the growth of social media and the impact of social media, that's something that wasn't there for years and always has an ability, I think, to amplify what is really minority voices to a much louder and broader stage.
Is it possible to build coalitions anymore, or at this moment in history? I mean, I look at even political parties in BC or federally as well. I mean, it seems like it's almost impossible now, because the both, as you say, the left and the right keep pulling us apart, even though the majority of us probably are somewhere in the center.
Well, you've got the Conservatives now, I think, are convulsed by the People's Party, and which has pushed them to the right. So the People's Party is basically a fringe party. It has very small number of supporters, but in a landscape or a political arena where every vote counts, where you've got minority governments, the Liberals forming power with less than a third of the vote, it means the Conservatives are finding themselves paying attention to a fringe party and hoping to secure enough votes to overtake the Liberals. And so that becomes less of a coalition, of a traditional coalition for Conservatives. So they're changing the nature of their identity. And you're seeing in BC, you're seeing the BC Liberals, which for a long time was the so-called Free Enterprise Coalition, first put together by W.A.C. Bennett, then reassessed assembled by Bill Bennett and assembled again by Gordon Campbell. It's now changing. It's becoming a more conservative party as it sort of hides its way away from the liberal part of the party. So political parties are changing all the time. And the NDP finds itself, as we saw in the leadership race, sort of at war internally with some environmental organizations, which sort of are on the left-wing part of the spectrum. So I think it is harder to construct these coalitions and to maintain them through the rise of some fringe on either side of the political spectrum, and then you throw in social media, and then the growing distrust with our institutions. It's tough for a mainstream party to remain intact as a coalition.
That it is. Keith, thank you.
All right, anytime.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.